Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Welcome to 2024. A new year is bringing a familiar tradition, new state laws. More than 800 bills were signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom, and many are now in effect. And for the better part of this month, we're going to unpack some of the most interesting and impactful. Today, we're going to focus on salary increases for some city council members across the state. Here to break it down is CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb, who will also get us up to speed on some significant and controversial developments within Sacramento's own governing body, from an official's pay to a federal indictment. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, so let's just dive into this new law. It is Senate Bill 329. It affects the salary caps for some city council members in the state. So what's the background behind this? What was the motivation for this legislation?
So these previous salary limits applied to most, but not all city council members across the state. The main motivation was to update these caps for interest rates. And on the low end, cities with a population of up to 35,000 people could pay council members $300 a month. And on the high end, in cities with more than 250,000 people, members could make up to $1,000 a month.
Oh, okay. So then what is this new law changing when it comes to the new salary limits?
The law increases the salary caps for council members in general law cities. So based on population, the new caps are $950 per month on the low end and $3,200 per month on the high end. The law also accounts for inflation in the future and allows council members to increase their salaries past these new caps in the future. And it also includes a couple of transparency measures, like requiring councils to discuss giving themselves raises during at least two regular meetings.
So when we're talking about these general law cities, I mean, this new caps are like anywhere from like $12,000 a year to like $36,000 a year. So it's not necessarily sizable. What is a general law city compared to a charter city like Sacramento?
The short version is charter cities operate under their own charters, while general law cities must follow general state laws. Charter cities basically have more authority over municipal affairs, and about 75% of California's 482 cities are general law cities, but it's common for bigger, more populous cities to be charter cities like Sacramento. As an example for a general law city here locally is Elk Grove.
Okay, and obviously that's close by. And 75% is a good chunk of cities in the state. So yeah. When was the last time that there were salary caps when it was adjusted for general law cities like Elk Grove?
1984. So the new caps make up for 40 years of inflation.
Okay, so it's been like four decades. And when it comes to the bill's author, State Senator Bill Dodd, his district covers parts of Sacramento and Yolo counties here. So why did he feel that now was the right time to address the pay of city council members?
So supporters say it was overdue to adjust the pay for four decades of inflation. And in the smallest cities, council members could see their pay jump from $300 to $950 per month. And just as an example of a place that falls under that category is Patterson in Stanislaus County. Two people I spoke with told me that council members need to do a lot of work. So to do a good job, they don't just sit in public meetings. They should spend time researching city issues and meeting with community members. So under previous caps, members could easily make less than state minimum wage for their labor.
Yeah. And the bill's author also argued that this new legislation, which is now a new state law, that it would help remedy what he called a discouraging public participation on city councils. So how will these higher salaries boost participation on councils?
Ideally, higher salaries will make it easier for people from diverse backgrounds to be able to afford to do the work or even decide to run and seek office in the first place. Political campaigns can be expensive, but that's a bit of a tangent. Supporters hope the better compensation will encourage more people from low-income backgrounds to serve on city councils, as well as younger people, parents of young kids, people who don't have generational wealth, and so on. That way, you don't end up with a council council of white retired lawyers and have a council that's more representative of the city. For context, the California-Hawaii State Conference of the NAACP was one of the orgs that supported the bill.
So when can these new salary raises begin?
The law went into effect yesterday, but a city can only implement salary increases for council members when at least one begins a new term. So for general law cities, where new council members are elected in November of this year, salary increases probably can't be implemented until late this year.
And as you mentioned, general law cities, there's 75% of the cities in the state are general law cities, but there's also charter cities like the city of Sacramento. Why did this law not apply to all cities?
Yeah, so charter cities can basically make their own rules on council member salaries. So charter cities can decide the amount, when it can be increased, and so on.
Okay, so when it comes to the city of Sacramento, how much do council members make?
As of this past June, Sacramento council members make about $103,000 a year. The city's Compensation Commission votes on salary increases for council members in public meetings, and that commission is made up of 5 city residents. It also determines the mayor's salary, too.
And that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Compared to general law cities. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb. So on the topic of pay increases, the Sacramento City Council did vote a couple weeks ago in December to give city manager Howard Chan a raise, but it turns out that it violated state law. So what's going on there?
Yeah, it was a violation of the Brown Act. That's a state law that requires local governments to do business openly and publicly. The act bans the council from holding special meetings about executives' salaries, but that's what the council did on December 12th. The council is supposed to vote on pay for Chan in regularly scheduled meetings. Special meetings can be held with only a day's notice versus regular meetings need at least 3 days' notice for the public. Mm.
You reported that this was the 6th raise in 7 years for the city manager. Why was another raise deemed necessary?
The proposed raise is based off of cost of living increases, according to a city staff report. The 5% raise would bring his base pay from about $400,000 to $420,000 a year. And if it gets passed again, we'll get into that a little later, it would go into effect retroactively to February of 2023. If we include this raise, like you said, the council has approved 6 pay increases for him in 7 years. Steinberg, it's worth noting that Mayor Steinberg, as well as council members Mai Vang and Katie Valenzuela, abstained from voting on the raises.
This additional raise has received some criticism from the public. What is the city's explanation?
Definitely, people have asked, why does Chan deserve this salary? Asking, what has he accomplished to justify this? Steinberg specifically has raised concerns over whether giving Chan and other city executives pay increases makes sense when there's a budget deficit in the forecast. The city hasn't really given an explanation other than the cost of living adjustment. But generally speaking, officials usually justify high pay for city managers by saying they're the city's chief executive officer, or they might also say that they're trying to retain city managers and avoid turnover by keeping them happy.
So when could the city council vote again, following proper procedures in line with the Brown Act, on this potential raise?
Yeah, I confirmed with the city spokesperson that the council plans to redo the vote next week Tuesday. The Sacramento Bee was the first to report on those plans. The council is having its regular meeting on January 9th, so that would be following the Brown Act this time.
And Kristen, I mean, it was a busy month for you. I mean, another development in December was council member Sean Lalowie. He was indicted last month on federal charges. And just last week, Mayor Steinberg has publicly called for his resignation. So walk us through the charges that Lalowie faces.
As the owner of the Viva Supermarket grocery store businesses, he faces a 25-count federal indictment. His co-defendant is Carla Montoya, the general manager of his stores. Lalowie and Montoya allegedly obstructed investigations by the U.S. Department of Labor and falsified immigration documents. They also allegedly withheld overtime wages and fraudulently obtained COVID-19 business relief funds. Lalowie pleaded not guilty on December 15th and is due back in court next month.
During public comment, and I've talked to the mayor about this when he joined us on Insight, you know, there were people in the community that called for Lalowie's resignation even before this indictment from, and that includes the Sacramento Central Labor Council to even some of the constituents as well. But Mayor Steinberg kept somewhat quiet, including when he joined us on Insight last month. That obviously has now changed. What is his reasoning to ask for Lalowie's resignation publicly now?
Yeah, I saw you had the mayor on the show just 2 days before the indictment news came out. And at the time, he told you that there were no formal charges against Lalowie. So he said that it would be fair to allow the federal investigation to finish. And if formal investigations came out, he told you it would be a different story. 2 days later, the 25-count indictment became public. That same day, Steinberg implied he wanted Lalowie to resign. He gave a statement saying he believed things would be resolved in 24 hours, and they weren't. The following week, Steinberg issued a statement saying he was talking with Lalowie regularly and thought the council member would, quote, do the right thing. But asking Lalowie to resign privately didn't work out. So the week after that, this past Thursday, the mayor went public and called on Lalowie to resign immediately.
Okay, so given that Lalowie hasn't indicated that he's intending to resign from his seat, what actions can the council or even city officials actually take?
A spokesperson from the city clerk's office told me that the mayor and the council don't have the authority to remove him from his seat. They also can't suspend him. She also said that it's unlikely that city manager Howard Chan could remove a council member, given that he reports to the council. They're sort of like his boss. But if there's one other aspect that raises questions, it has to do with Sean Lalowie's residency. A judge ordered him to stay in his wife's Granite Bay home instead of his house in Sacramento because his co-defendant lives in his Sacramento home.
So, and Granite Bay is in Placer County.
Yes, on a whole different county, way far out of his district in the North Sacramento area. So that renews last year's eligibility question about whether he can even hold office legally in Sacramento. Steinberg has asked the city attorney to give an opinion on whether Lalowie can legally keep his council seat.
If council member Lalowie changes his mind, decides to step down, what would the next steps be?
If he resigns, then the city would appoint someone to fill the seat for the rest of the term. It's set to end in December 2024. The city would have to accept applications for the appointment, and it wouldn't affect this year's city council elections. District 2 residents will still vote for a new council member in the March 5th primary election. If one candidate wins more than 50% of the vote, they will join the council in December of this year. But if no candidate meets that threshold, the top two vote getters will face off in the November general election. The winner takes office in December.
And the council member Lalowie, if I'm correct, he previously said he's not running for re-election, right? So
correct.
How many candidates are running for the seat currently that are going to be on the ballot for the March primary?
Yeah, so the filing deadline was last month. Lalowie didn't file to run for re-election, so he can't at this point. And there are 9 candidates that got their papers approved to run for the seat representing District 2. That includes Del Paso Heights, Old North Sacramento, and Woodlake. It's worth noting that the candidates include the chief of staff for Lalowie's council district office, Veronica Smith, as well as Roger Dickinson, a former state lawmaker and former Sacramento County supervisor.
Kristen, thanks so much for walking us through a lot of developments.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Lamb is Cap Radio's Sacramento government reporter. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. January 1st, of course, marks a new year, but it also marks the beginning of higher bills if you're a PG&E customer. As of yesterday, PG&E bills will go up on average $33 a month. PG&E says it needs the money to pay for undergrounding lines in wildfire-prone areas, among other safety improvements. But this rate hike follows a series of increases in recent years and might not be the only one in store for 2024. Just weeks after the current increase was approved by the CPUC, that's the California Public Utilities Commission, PG&E requested for another one to take effect later this year. If that gets approved, ratepayers can expect an additional $12 a month tacked onto their bill on top of the $33 on average that begins this month. So why is this happening? And what happens to people who can't afford the increases? And are there alternatives to rate hikes? We reached out to PG&E and they were unable to join us this morning, but we do have two guests today. Mark Toney is the executive director of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, that is a ratepayer advocacy organization. And Meredith Fowley is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and the faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas. Good morning. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Meredith, I want to start with you because we had you on back in November, and this was ahead of the CPUC's meeting that eventually it approved the rate hikes, which kicked in yesterday on January 1. So let's just set the table by explaining what that rate hike was. What was it for back in November?
Yeah, so and maybe taking even a bigger step back just to remind everyone sort of what's going on here. So PG&E is a regulated utility, right, which means it can't just decide how much to charge its customers. It needs to sort of ask permission from the Public Utility Commission, as you mentioned. And then the CPUC reviews that request and decides whether it's warranted, and if not, how it's going to adjust that request. So back in November, we had one of the largest rate cases I can remember. Mark can maybe remember larger ones, but in my memory, this was a big one. PG&E had initially proposed to increase its revenue requirement by like $15.4 billion. And as you mentioned, that would increase bills significantly. After hearing comments and arguments, including really important arguments from Mark and his colleagues at TURN, the CPUC reduced that request by about $1 billion. So they approved a revenue requirement that would increase bills by about 13% versus 18%. And as we talked about, and we can get into this, there were many sort of drivers. This is a pretty complex collection of imperatives that we're talking about in terms of what's driving the rate increases. But the top of the list, at least top of my list, we'll be interested to hear from Mark, is mitigating the risk of catastrophic wildfire and the costs associated with undergrounding in particular. But we're also talking about improving reliability and preparing for increases in customer load growth. And that's sort of part and parcel of our efforts to decarbonize, because we're really hoping households and firms will electrify. That means more customers and an increased importance for reliable supply.
So wildfire safety and also, you know, the big push by the state to electrify the state and to push more towards away from gas and more towards electricity. You mentioned that PG&E originally asked for more money and the CPUC approved a lesser amount. But then weeks later, the PG&E is now requesting an additional $2 billion rate increase from the CPUC. The CPUC has not voted on that yet. So did that come as a surprise to you, given that a rate increase was already approved just weeks prior?
Well, I'll turn over to, I'm interested to hear what Mark says. I wasn't completely surprised, because when the PUC issued its decision, the PG&E said, that's not enough. We've got these significant investments that we need to make in wildfire safety and wildfire risk mitigation, and what you just approved doesn't cover what it's going to cost us. And there are also, and we don't have to get too deep into the weeds, but there are sort of adjustments that PG&E can ask for, even under an existing case, saying actually it cost us more than we anticipated, and so we're coming back to you to cover those unanticipated costs.
If these additional funds get approved, are they essentially going to go towards, you know, the same mission to reduce wildfire risk and also to support, you know, an increased electrification, you know, across the state?
Yep. So, I mean, the devil's in the details, but wildfire for me is top of mind. Reliability more generally it costs money to improve reliability. And I think the overarching idea here that I think we need to keep top of mind is that it does cost money to provide safe, reliable, sustainable power supply. And as we mentioned before, I mean, January 1st, we all make New Year's resolutions. I think if there's two, for me, the question is not whether it's going to cost more. It's going to cost more, but cost containment and affordability. You know, we really, if we want to meet these objectives, we need to lean into thinking about how to meeting those objectives at least cost, and think really carefully about who's going to pay. And that's where Mark and his colleagues have been playing such an important role.
When it comes to this latest request, when could the CPUC make a decision on this?
You know, I will be honest, I'm not this year, certainly, but I have not been keeping close tabs on the exact dates of when these decisions are going to come forward.
And just for some context, we're talking about, you know, one proposed additional increase, which followed a recent approval of an increase. But this follows a series of ongoing rate increases in recent years, right, Meredith?
It does. And if you think about it, maybe we'll get into this in more detail later. I mean, PG&E set a goal back in 2021 to underground 100,000 miles of electric distribution lines. And so if they maintain that promise, we're going to be looking at more and more and more increases going forward. So this is not the last increase we'll be talking about, I don't think.
Mm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're discussing PG&E's latest request for a rate hike, which is on top of the one that was just recently approved and kicked in yesterday on January 1. Okay, Mark, I want to turn to you because you're with TURN. That is the Utility Reform Network. It's a ratepayer advocacy organization. You joined us following the CPUC approving a rate increase, which happened in November. And I'm curious, you know, what are you thinking now that there's another potential rate increase that could take effect later this year?
On December 30th, PG&E filed a notice that the actual increase for January is going to be $34.50 a month. So that's the latest update. Just 2 weeks after they got approval for their big rate increase, the $2 billion that they're asking for, in the newspaper when they printed the notice, it said the bill impact would be $24 a month. That is according to what PG&E published in the newspaper in their official notice. And the worst thing is they're asking for early collection. They want to start collecting March 1st of this year. The extra 24, which goes on top of the $34.50. Now, let me tell you, Meredith is absolutely correct that the way that utility regulation works is utilities are supposed to ask for money before they spend it, get permission and authorization before. But there's a big loophole now where utilities can spend the money first and come collect later. They can overspend. And so this $2 billion is money that was spent between 2020 and 2022. It's money already spent. And what TURN is demanding is that the CPUC has to do on-the-ground inspections to make sure that the right measures were taken in the right locations for the right results, or else they should not get a penny, because PG&E has a bad record of not doing the right thing.
Hmm. Okay, so you mentioned $34.50 starting January 1 and potentially an additional $24 come this spring. So that's nearly $50 a month for ratepayers. That's like $600 a year. I mean, are there any measures in place to protect ratepayers, to protect consumers from significant financial burdens, Mark?
TURN is fighting for a cap on future increases. We have a campaign for affordable power, CAP, and the cap is set at the cost of living adjustment provided by Social Security. That should be the limit on how much rates should increase every year and not double digits year after year after year, like Meredith was saying. In fact, this past rate increase was record-breaking. The reason Meredith thought it was bigger than anything she had seen is because it was the highest in history. And we just cannot keep doing that. It's not only going to cause more disconnections, more people being thrown into the streets, being pushed into homelessness because they can't afford their utility bills, but it's going to undermine California climate goals. Because when the price of electricity, and Meredith, she and her colleagues at UC Berkeley have documented that when the price of electricity goes higher than the price of fossil fuels, people are going to be resistant. Here's one thing people don't like. People don't like being punished for doing the right thing. People don't like the idea of, I'm going to get an electric stove, I'm going to get electric heat, a heat pump, and now I'm going to have to pay more every month. We're supposed to reward people for doing the right thing with lower bills, not punish them.
Meredith, you mentioned, it is just going to cost more. That is just a reality that we have to grapple with. But there's also, as Mark is highlighting, there's a societal cost as well. Are rate increases the only answer to this?
No. And I guess maybe if I can take a step back, because I think Mark raised some really important points that I want to draw out a little bit. I think this is all happening against this backdrop of a history in California of utilities, and PG&E in particular, starting wildfires, right? So 5 of the past 10 most destructive fires since 2015 were linked to PG&E's network. And regulators did find that in some cases, PG&E had violated state laws or could have been doing more, right? So against that sort of history, PG&E has acknowledged mistakes and said, we are making ambitious commitments to doing better. Doing better costs a lot more. So I think we can all agree that PG&E should be doing more. But there are these really high stakes disagreements about how much more and how we should approach this. So this approach to to undergrounding lines, I think on one hand sounds appealing, right? And PG&E's CEO, Patty Poppe, has argued that, there's no better way to reduce wildfire risk than to put them underground at a cost of $3 million per mile. And she's made this point, who wants to get on a plane that has a 35% chance of crashing, referring to the fact that other measures reduce risk by maybe 65, 70% versus 100%. However, it's not a 35% risk, right? Even the most high risk lines, the risk of wildfire on a given day is still below, around 0.1%. So we're working with a low risk baseline when we're thinking about how much we're going to reduce. So I think Mark and other stakeholders have really been pushing back on this idea that undergrounding is the only way. There are other ways to mitigate risk. When you live in California, you have to live with some wildfire risk. We're not going to eliminate wildfire risk. And so I think there's a really important conversation about how much we should be putting into undergrounding versus fast trip settings or covered conductors or other tools we have to reduce risk. So that's one. The other thing is, so it's going to cost us money no matter what we choose. Mark's point is, how do we recover those costs? And why we're asking ratepayers to reduce wildfire risk is a question we should be asking, right? Why is that on the electricity bill versus the state budget? So, it's a really important question that we need to keep asking as rates keep climbing, right? We don't pay for other climate change adaptation investments on our power bills. Why is this one the key driver of rate increases?
Yeah, Mark. Okay. So, you're with an advocacy organization. How do you approach this from a legislative arm? Do you work with state lawmakers to try and see if you can get it into the budget and kind of offset the burden that ratepayers are shouldering?
There are a number of things that PG&E can do to reduce the ratepayer burden. One is they can apply for billions of dollars of federal funding for infrastructure for the wildfire mitigation, which they are refusing to do because it's not profitable. because the way they're doing things now produces tremendous profits for Wall Street investors. So that's one. Two, like Meredith said, we can look, it is so much more fair to charge. Look at it this way. With utility bills, the lower your income, the higher percentage of your take-home pay goes into paying that bill. With the income tax system, the higher your income, the higher percentage you pay. And if you're low income and you get an earned income tax credit, you might be paying negative income tax because you're getting a refund. When's the last time you heard somebody get a negative utility bill in a month? Okay. So the point is that there are more equitable ways to be able to pay for things. Also, ratepayers should not be paying for electric vehicle charging stations. Let the transportation sector pay for that. Let the building sector figure out how to finance building electrification. The ratepayers have done their fair share, billions of dollars, to decarbonize the whole generation, electrical generation field. It's simply not fair. My final point on this that Meredith was talking about, the judge at the CPUC judge who issued the initial proposal agreed with Tern that insulating overhead power lines is faster and cheaper and just as safe as burying the lines. And so the CPUC, Public Utilities Commission, had an option to choose a faster, cheaper, and just as safe option, and they buckled in to PG&E executives and to Wall Street investors by choosing the slower, more expensive, and considerably more profitable option.
And when you say insulating the ones that are currently above ground, as opposed to actually, you know, moving, you know, as Meredith said, the initial goal of 100 or 10,000 miles underground.
10,000, yeah, that's right. Well, look, when you insulate overhead lines, you're doing two things. One is new lines that are insulated. So you're not insulating the existing, but you get brand new lines that are insulated, and you get brand new electrical poles that are also insulated because the current poles cannot carry the additional weight. Guess what? Insulated lines weigh more than bare metal lines, which is what we've got now. So you've got, I've seen these with my own eyes too. So you have brand new poles, they're insulated, and insulated lines. That's what makes them safe.
Yeah, PG&E is one of the largest utility companies in the country. It's certainly the largest in California. It serves like 16 million customers. It goes from like Bakersfield pretty much all the way up to the Oregon border. You know, is there a gold standard within California that we can look to? I mean, I know undergrounding has taken place with San Diego Gas and Electric. I mean, are other utility companies doing a better job, not only for safety, but also it being cost effective? Meredith?
I will say, PG&E is the biggest, right? 100,000 miles of electric distribution lines, more than, I think, 25,000 of those are in high-risk areas. So it is, in some senses, an unfair comparison to look at SDG&E and say it's costing them less when they have so much less area and less high fire districts. So I think the question, I'm willing to bet that the right solution involves some undergrounding in the highest, highest risk areas. But I think we need to be thinking a lot harder because, as Mark mentioned or alluded to, PG&E does earn a rate of return on capital investment. So they have a reason to favor more capital investment undergrounding over some of these other options. So I think just what the CPUC has started to do, it really needs to lean into doing more of, which is scrutinizing the proposed response to escalating wildfire risk and making sure it strikes the right balance between safety, which we're all interested in, and affordability, which we have a moral obligation to be focused on.
Mark, I know you wanted to jump into this.
Yeah, I'd like to answer also. Southern California Edison is a good example. They have already insulated over 5,000 miles of overhead power lines. They plan to have 7,000 miles done by the end of 2024. Now, they just started this project a few years ago. So it cost them $800,000 a mile. So we know how much it costs, okay? And we know how fast it can be done. PG&E claims that it all the records, that, and that's actual. The actual amount PG&E has spent historically to underground lines is $4 million, okay? I know that Patricia K. Poppy is claiming they can do it for $3 million. I am telling you the record shows $4 million is the actual, and the same as $800,000 is an actual. Okay, those are actual figures. And it's going to take them decades to get 10,000 miles. And when it comes to wildfire safety, when you live in a high wildfire safety zone, I know that you want your wires to be made safe within a couple years, rather than 20 years.
Mark and Meredith, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Toney is the executive director of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, that is a ratepayer advocacy organization. And Meredith Fowley is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley and the faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas. And as we mentioned, we did invite PG&E on the show and they were unable to join us. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Resolutions, regardless if you are a believer or you just roll your eyes at the tradition, a new year is usually a time when a lot of us think about wellness, and health can mean a lot of things. It can mean committing more time to fitness, prioritizing mental health, perhaps a work-life balance, eating better, especially after the past couple weeks, reducing stress, maybe even taking up a new hobby or a pastime. The list obviously is long, it is varied, but often they relate to each other. So we're going to bring in some minds that have dedicated their lives and professions to helping others incorporate healthy habits that can meet different lifestyles and abilities, from finding activities that bring you joy, as well as physical comfort, as well as taking advantage of all the agriculture that's in our backyard, not only to eat healthier, but also with more enjoyment and a connection to where it comes from. Dr. Brandi Waite is the director of the UC Davis Health Sports Medicine Department, and Skylar Hanka is with Culinary Health at the UC Davis Office of Wellness Education. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having us.
So come January 1st for me, you know, it wasn't really, I didn't really necessarily feel like reinvigorated. I had a great time, spent lots of time with loved ones, but I was like, man, I really need like a reset button. So I guess just out of curiosity, how are both of you feeling for the new year?
I feel great. I'm one of those weird people that actually likes New Year's resolutions, and I'm about 60% on actually keeping them. About maybe two-thirds of them I actually keep. So I'm looking forward to it. I came up with a name for mine this year. I like to name them and make a whole thing about it. So I'm happy about it.
Wait, I think
what's,
I need to
what's
take the
that. Name?
2024 and more.
Oh, I love that.
Ooh, I like that.
How about you?
I actually, on the opposite of the spectrum, I recently fractured my foot about 2 months ago. So this year
year's resolutions look very different from a lot of resolutions I've had in the past. And I've had to rethink a lot of the ways that I'm viewing kind of my movement and my nutrition currently. So, you know, I feel like maybe a lot of other people can relate to feeling a little bit confused when it comes to the new year and just trying to figure things out in a better way.
Oh, I have been in your situation before on crutches for a few months. And it definitely is a humbling experience and makes you reevaluate and rethink ways to be moved, to move and be healthy and just to stay healthy mind and both physically as well. Well, Dr. Waite, you know, I want to start with you because I'd love to learn about your background in physical medicine and rehabilitation.
Yes. So in physical medicine and rehabilitation, we really focus on function. So neurologic rehabilitation, musculoskeletal, meaning your muscles and bones rehabilitation. So how to live better in your body, regardless of what injuries or illnesses are fighting your best efforts to live the best life you can in the body that you have.
And you, I mean, have even worked at such an elite level from being the team physician for Sac Republic FC. You've worked with the Sacramento Ballet. You are you work with collegiate sports teams, you know, at UC Davis and American River College. But you also work with other people of all like abilities and levels. How do you curate your care to meet people where they're at?
I love my beginner athletes. And a lot of my patients, they say, I don't know why I'm in sports medicine because I'm not an athlete. I don't do sports. And I think of everyone as an athlete in life. Like you've got to succeed in your life and your goals may look different than professional athletes, but your goals are really valid. And I have lots of little tricks and tools that I give to beginners. And I get just as excited about people meeting their little miniature goals as I do for my athletes that are meeting major goals.
How do you suggest someone gets active if maybe they've been sedentary for quite some time?
So I have a saying that perfection is the enemy of progress.
Yes.
And I like for people to not worry about being perfect. They should pick something that's doable, not a grandiose, you know, a grandiose goal, but a small goal that's very specific. Like, all right, I enjoy walking, so I want to walk for 15 minutes three times a week this month and set that as a goal. Or gosh, it really hurts when I walk because my knee, my hip, my ankle, my foot, what have you. So I'm going to do some seated exercises, or I'm not a walker. My mobility is in a wheelchair, but I need to still be physically active. So I'm going to find an upper body exercise plan that I can do for 15 minutes with the music on that I like, or with the people that I like, or while I'm watching a show that I like, and find a way to tie it to something that you enjoy, because you're much more likely to stick with it if it's something that's not just an onerous task or chore.
Yeah. And I love that quote you have about, you know, perfection, because when we approach something in that way, it's not necessarily kind, and there could be shame attached to it if you don't execute it perfectly, or you fall off for like a couple days or so. So in terms of like the mental component to it, it's also showing ourselves kindness and compassion and grace.
Absolutely. You know, there's, unless you're getting paid to do your fitness, the other things take priority sometimes. You have kids or parents or other people to take care of, or your job just threw this deadline on you because somebody else had to go out sick and you've, you know, are doing two jobs now. So I think giving yourself grace and realizing that, you know, a 5 or 10 minute commitment to your activity sometimes is better than, you know, if it can't be your hour or your 30 minutes, your 5 or 10 minutes is still keeping you in the mode of having that as a priority.
Yeah, recently in December, I started taking up just 5 or 10 minutes of stretching every day. You know, I didn't really prioritize that. It was easier for me to like show up to the gym or maybe go for a run. But stretching is so important for your joints and just for your overall fit. And it also just feels good.
It does feel good.
Okay, Skylar. So you work in culinary health and you work at a pretty cool office, the Office of Wellness Education. When did you become passionate about not only food and cooking, but also the connection that it has to wellness?
Yeah. So I actually went to the Culinary Institute of America for my undergrad in culinary arts. And I kind of had this pivotal moment where I could go and get a bachelor's in restaurant management. But I took a couple nutrition courses there and was just fascinated with, you know, the food as medicine concept and just how food interacts with our health. So I switched gears and got my bachelor's in nutrition and went on to get my master's. But really, I love this idea that everything's connected. And I think that's so important when we talk about wellness, because there's so many different aspects of things that interact. And for me, food is one aspect that connects not only yourself on a personal level, but it connects community, it connects us to the planet. Like, it's just really this wonderful thing, and everybody loves to eat. So
how do you describe functional medicine?
Yeah, I'd kind of describe functional medicine as an approach that incorporates, like I said, this idea of looking at lifestyle medicine, looking at food and looking at movement and looking at the functionality of it in our lives. When we look at functional medicine, we look at how these different aspects interact and how they hopefully optimize our health.
Mm. And I would imagine that also involves like eating with the seasons, which can be pretty easy here in Sacramento.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% eating with the seasons, especially in California. We're very blessed to have an abundance of amazing farmers here, especially in winter. We have a lot of citrus in season right now. We have winter squashes, which full of vitamin C and all this good stuff. So we're really lucky if you can hit a farmer's market, because you'll see the abundance of fruits and vegetables that California has to offer.
How does, obviously eating seasonable is delicious, right? Because everything is ripe and in the right, it's in the right time. But how does eating according to the seasons also support your health?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, here in California right now, we're in peak citrus season and winter squashes. So when you eat with the season, usually the foods that grow during that season have an abundance of minerals and vitamins and other things that you need during that season. So citrus full of vitamin C, which helps support your immunity. Winter squashes, like I mentioned, have a lot of fiber, also have a lot of vitamin C, vitamin E, and other antioxidants in them that help support your overall health and your cellular health. Beyond that, I think a lot of the times when you eat with the seasons, kind of that food as medicine approach is less focused on caloric content or restriction and is more focused on diversity and abundance and just getting whole foods into your body and into your dietary preferences, whatever you're doing. So you really get to diversify your nutrients.
This is also a time when someone may be thinking about taking up a diet. I guess, what is your philosophy when it comes to diets or whether to even do them?
Yeah, I think I'm a bit anti-diet. I'm not gonna lie there. I think that's why I kind of love the food as medicine perspective, because like I said, it's less about caloric restriction and following strict rules, but really more about exploring your own personal philosophy with food, how it relates, and optimizing your intake based on eating things that you enjoy, which kind of eating with the seasons, peak flavor, peak freshness, you're going to get a lot of things that maybe you thought you might not like, but if you eat them in the season, they're going to taste a little bit better.
When it comes to someone who maybe like grocery shopping isn't like their favorite thing in the world, or even cooking for that matter, I mean, it can be, you know, a chore or feel like a burden, you know, with all the stuff that goes on in your life. How do you guide people to shop and to also cook in a way that is manageable for their lifestyle?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's going to be different for everyone, but I always tell people to start that if you can, definitely make a trip to a farmer's market. I think even if you don't enjoy grocery shopping and you're not really a big cook, when you venture into this community of people who, you know, there's an abundance of fresh foods and colorful things and everyone's happy and there's a smell of fresh bread in the air, you know, it's kind of hard not to kind of fall in love with that environment, and it'll hopefully give you a different perspective, because when we go to the grocery store, everything's very organized, very, you know, everything looks the same, etc. But farmers markets really celebrate diversity, not only in food, but in community. And hopefully you can talk to the farmer or maybe speak to someone at the stand and they'll give you a recipe. You can also, you know, find an influencer that you like online. I think we all love watching recipe videos on Instagram, maybe to give you a little bit of inspiration for something that you'd want to cook in your own home.
Yeah. And a couple of the farmers markets I'm thinking of, there's even like live music as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Live music, plenty of things to do, fun for the kids as well. So it's a good time.
Yeah, when it comes to food and also fitness, you know, sometimes it's tied to cost, right? And financial means. And so if someone's thinking about, you know, obviously the cost of groceries have gone up in recent years, the cost of lots of things have gone up in recent years. How do you advise someone who wants to start eating healthier, wants to start, you know, a healthier lifestyle, become more active, but they don't feel like they have the financial means to actually do so?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely what Dr. Waite had said earlier about not changing everything at once. You know, don't feel like you have to revamp your whole diet, because that's usually where you feel a lot of the cost burdens, because you're like, oh, I need to go buy pumpkin seeds and sprouts and all of these crazy things. You can revamp your diet by maybe just focusing on one meal. And I know I keep mentioning the farmer's market, but going back to that eating in the seasons, typically when you eat with the season, that produce is usually more affordable because it's being grown in abundance during that season. So kind of taking an example right now, butternut squash and winter squash. I think it's like, was it 85 cents per pound, 50 cents per pound? You can go make a delicious butternut squash soup for probably under $3 with some coconut milk and some other vegetables and have that be your wellness meal of the week. You know, you don't have to do everything at once.
And how about you, Dr. Wade? How do you advise people who feel like it's cost prohibitive? Because it doesn't have to be. You can just go outside and enjoy the fresh air.
That's the wonderful thing about physical activity. Some people love the gym and some people hate the gym. And so it doesn't have to be something that you have a paid subscription to do. There are a lot of free online resources. There's a, you know, there's free online Tai Chi for people who want to move in that way for some stretching and balance. You can get outside or even exercise in your own home. I have a good friend actually who is an NFL Hall of Fame wide receiver. And when he used to travel, he couldn't exercise in the gyms because people would ask for his autograph and he couldn't. So he would literally run in place in his hotel room, and that cost nothing. And it was enough to help keep an NFL wide receiver in shape during times away. So you can just march in front of the television or you can sit in front of the television moving or listening to music. And those things don't cost a lot of money, or just find a beautiful place. There's been a lot of studies looking at time in nature as a wonderful thing for your overall health. So find a beautiful place that's outside and, you know, lie down on a mat and do some exercise or walk around that space, walking around if your kids are at soccer practice or something like that. Walk around the field, just be that parent. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, there's that parent. That's me. I'm doing burpees over on the side or walking around when kids are at those things. So finding a way to bring them together without an extra cost is doable. It just takes a little creativity.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Vicki.
Dr. Brandi Waite is the director of the UC Davis Health Sports Medicine, and Skylar Hanko works in culinary health at the UC Davis Office of Wellness Education. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's it for Insight. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.